Bulletproof Radio, a state of high performance.
You're listening to Bulletproof Radio with Dave Asprey.
Quick question for you. What makes you feel more invigorated, less stressed, and more in control of your body? The answer, more energy. Specifically, more quantum energy, because our bodies are quantum systems. Leela Quantum Tech has figured out a way to harness quantum energy so you can reach a state of vibrancy that you've probably never felt. Dozens of studies show that Leela Q's products neutralize the effects of harmful EMFs around us and even release positive energy that can improve your blood flow, optimize your heart rate, and other benefits. Leela Q has some heavy science backing it up. A recent study looked at people who use Leela Q for just 10 minutes. The study used a special blood illumination technique called dark field microscopy, and it showed significant protective and improvement effects on blood flow. So take a quantum leap into higher vibration at LeelaQ.com/Dave and claim your exclusive 10% discount.
Hey there, ice bath lovers. Do you want to take your cold exposure game up a notch with some contrast therapy? Well, you should, because cold plunges and contrast therapy can lower stress, up your immunity, and even help you sleep better. It works better than just cold therapy alone. Well, now you can do that with the new Michael Phelps Chili Goat Cold Tubs by Master Spas. Whether you want to relax in a hot soak or get energized with a cold plunge, the Michael Phelps Chili Goat Cold Tub has you covered. You can easily hop out of the hot water, get in the cold water, and go back and forth. When you do that, you get better results in less time, and that's what biohacking is all about. Go to chiligoattubs.com, use promo code DAVE500, and you can save $500 on any Chili Goat Cold Tub. I have one in my backyard. That's chiligoattubs.com, promo code DAVE500.
Today's cool fact of the day is that the Tesla Model S scored 5 out of 5 stars by the National Highway Safety Administration in the U.S. That's the highest score any car's ever had in the history of the automobile. It was so good that it even broke the machine that was supposed to crush the car during a rollover test. So that's what I call bulletproof.
Everyone's talking about red light therapy beds, and for good reason. There's a company called ARRC LED that's building an entirely new class of LED devices. ARRC LED beds integrate proprietary scanning technology and frequency protocols to shape the delivery of 6 different wavelengths in dose-optimized photobiomodulation. Yes, that's a lot of words. What it is, though, is that photobiomodulation improves the underlying energetics of the cells in your body. And those changes can benefit nearly every tissue and organ and system in your body. You change your cells and you change your life. For more information, visit arrcled.com.
Today's guests are unusual. I have no financial ties, no incentive to be working with these guys, but it's phenomenal work. And it's 2 guests today. One of them is Eric Merola, who's an international award-winning documentary filmmaker, and Ralph Maas, who's a PhD, the executive director of CancerDecisions.com, and the former assistant director of public affairs at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York, and also a founding advisor to the NIH Office of Alternative Medicine. The reason that I've asked these guys on the show today is to talk about their new movie, which is called Second Opinion, which is a really incredible story about how a young science writer, Ralph Maas as a young man, risked his entire career by blowing the whistle on a cover-up involving cancer therapy. Now, Ralph, you and I haven't had a chance to talk in person before, but I run the Silicon Valley Health Institute. It's an anti-aging nonprofit group based in Silicon Valley, obviously, based in Palo Alto. And for 20 years, we've had luminaries in anti-aging and alternative medicine come in and give lectures once a month, and we've got many years of video online for free. And in that time, I've had more than a few people call me and say, Dave, I have cancer. I have really, really bad cancer. What do I do? And my answer is, look, I'm not a doctor, and I know a few things about a few alternative treatments. But if you want to see someone who's done the analysis from a scientific perspective, looking at both alternative and Western medicine, you always go to cancer decisions. So I've referred countless people to your work because I consider it to be open-minded yet science-based review. And if I was looking a diagnosis of cancer in the face, I would want the information that you do. So you've already earned my respect long before you made this movie. In fact, it's the depth of your own research and the research that I've read that actually made me want to invite you on the show. So number one, thanks for that work and welcome to the show, Ralph.
Thank you very much.
If you're watching on iTunes and or on YouTube, you can see Eric, but you don't see Ralph because Ralph's audio and video connection wasn't good enough. So we've got the best audio we can get there. And you'll be looking at Eric most of the time. And Ralph, sorry, we're not looking at each other eye to eye, but still, it's a pleasure to get to speak to you in person.
Same here.
Now, Eric, you've also got a kind of a cool story here. You worked on part of Michael Moore's feature documentary, Capitalism, A Love Story. And this is your third documentary that you're working on?
Correct. That's right. Before doing my own documentaries, I've worked in animation and post-production in TV and film for a long time. And yeah, I did a really hilarious sort of animated bit for Capitalism, A Love Story, where George Bush was basically telling the world that the whole financial system is going to collapse. And so I animated sort of all hell breaking loose behind his speaking at the podium.
Oh, nice. Now, I want to sort of interview both of you, which is a little tough over Skype, but it's kind of cool because both of you are very accomplished people and you're both high performing, but you came together. And how did you guys come together to make this movie? Did you know each other ahead of time? Or, is there a good story there?
I'll start actually with that. And I'll let Ralph pick it up. Essentially, living in New York City, long train rides home, I always like to have my friend, my book, and my backpack just to have something to read. I was walking by a used bookstore in New York City, saw a book titled The Cancer Industry sitting on the outside sort of bargain bin shelf. It had been published around 1980. The title just really caught my eye, sounded interesting. Also, wasn't very much money. And I read it, and I couldn't put it down. And I must have read it 10 times. I was filled with highlights and post-it notes. And again, I never made my own documentary film at that point, but I felt, wow, what an amazing story as a subject for a documentary film. So I actually made an attempt to get Ralph to do this back in 2007. And I think it was just bad timing for him. And I had no real documentary credentials to speak of at the time. And I went off in another direction and did two documentaries based on another chapter in his book about a scientist named Dr. Brzezinski. But then we came back around again, and I presented it to Ralph again, and he agreed. And in fact, I'm happy we waited because I've learned so much as a filmmaker, and I couldn't be more proud of this final product, of Second Opinion. I just don't know if it would have been nearly as good if I had done it back in 2007. So that's sort of the short story.
That's amazing. And Ralph, I mean, your experience in the cancer industry goes way back. What made you decide to do a documentary now versus a while ago?
Well, I think Eric had to convince me because, I mean, aside from, you know, his experience or lack of experience in the film business, I asked you, when you go through some sort of traumatic experience, as I did at Sloan Kettering, and then you publicize it, and I did a lot of publicity around my book, The Cancer Industry, starting about 1980, but then I went on and I did a lot of other things in the cancer field. And I have a lot of other thoughts about other than just Laetrol. Laetrol was the subject that got me, sort of propelled me into this field, or at least as a public figure in the field. But I felt like I wanted to move on from it. But Eric convinced me really that the story hadn't been told. First of all, I mean, a whole new generation of people had arisen, many of whom weren't alive in the 1970s when this all occurred. My book, Cancer Industry, was sort of, as Eric said, sort of relegated to the bargain basement shelf at Strand Bookstore. And more importantly, as it turned out, there was a lot more to learn and to say about Laetrol. I guess I was too close to it in the 1970s and 1980 to realize what a fascinating story it was, what a fascinating compound it is, and what real potential it still has as a possible treatment for cancer. So once Eric and I decided to do the film about 3 years ago, 4 years ago, then I started my own sort of reinvestigation of this whole Laidlaw question, Laidlaw controversy. And I actually wrote a book that came out recently called Doctored Results, which is a very detailed 250-page analysis of exactly what happened at Sloan Kettering, stuff that we couldn't go into in the film, and a lot of stuff, frankly, that I discovered and realized after we shot the film, after we did the filming, which was in 2012. I kept working on the book, and the book came out this year. And I mean, I'm sort of still kind of blown away by the how diabolical this was, even though I was involved in it and was a little sort of a pawn in their game. But, you know, I subtitled Doctored Results, The Suppression of Laidlaw at Sloan Kettering Institute of Cancer Research. And I thought long and hard over that title. Was the word suppression too sensationalist, but it isn't. It's actually what happened. A good and a promising treatment was suppressed because of personal reasons and economic reasons on the part of the leadership of the institute that I worked for.
So what was the treatment? Like, tell people who are maybe driving right now and aren't familiar with what Laidlaw is. Tell them where it comes from and how it got even to be of interest as a cancer compound.
Right. Laidlaw is just really just another name for amygdalin. Amygdalin is a common chemical found in the fruit pits of various of fruits of the apple, apricot, peach, almond family. That's a whole big family of trees, and there's the pit, and then if you take a hammer or a nutcracker, you open up that pit. Inside, there's a softer, more edible portion called the kernel. And these kernels, these apricot pits and kernels, are pretty much a waste product of the apricot canning industry. So the price on them is very, very low. This is very important to understand. They're almost a throwaway item. A man named Ernst Krebs, who was a graduate student, Ernst Krebs Jr., was a graduate student at the University of California, Berkeley. And for various reasons, none of which were terribly good in retrospect, he developed the idea that these kernels would be useful in treating cancer. Now, he may or may not have known that in traditional Chinese medicine, peach kernels are used as a treatment for lung inflammation and lung diseases. So he lived in San Francisco, you know, within walking distance of Chinatown. And I've often wondered whether part of his quote-unquote research wasn't going around and, you know, talking to these traditional Chinese healers, or it was just a huge coincidence.
His name is Krebs. Is he related to the Krebs of the Krebs cycle, the citric acid cycle for cellular? No, different guy. Cool.
Another coincidence, and to compound the coincidence, the word Krebs in German means cancer. It also means crab. Of course, crab is the word cancer in Latin, means crab, and it means the disease cancer, and in German, it's the same deal. Krebs in German means crab, or it means cancer. So here's these cancer researchers who have the name cancer, and he was a little crabby at times too, so, you know, maybe it pertained in that way as well. But in any case, he and his father, Ernst D. Krebs Sr., who was a physician in San Francisco, and another brother, the three of them basically invented this substance, and they gave it the name Laidlaw, which they thought they had invented a unique patentable product, but they never were really able to make that product. So really from the beginning, which was the early 1950s, they were marketing amygdalin, manufacturing it in their basement, marketing it and calling it Laetrol. This is the source of a tremendous amount of confusion. Even to this day, there was a paper published just a couple of months ago where very bright scientists in Germany doing wonderful work, but they sort of got it a little bit wrong in terms of the relationship between Laetrol and amygdalin. For all practical purposes, these are the same things. So what happened next was, and how I became involved, was that there were so many people who believed that Laetrol was beneficial to cancer patients. They got up a petition of 43,000 people to ask the President of the United States, Richard Nixon at that time, to test Laetrol in humans. And Nixon didn't know what to make of this. He gave it to his so-called cancer czar. The cancer czar, Benno Schmidt, was also an officer of Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. So he then asked his cancer center to test this. And they started testing it in 1972. And then I came on in 1974. I was hired as science writer and later assistant director of public affairs at Memorial Sloan Kettering. And so they were already, the program of testing Laetrol in animals was already well underway by the time that I got there.
So it was basically invented in the 40s, and it was already being tested because these guys had basically started selling it. So honestly, that's kind of the classic recipe for, you know, for it being a scam, right? You know, you could, we had these traveling medicine people back in the Old West kind of thing. So it didn't start out looking pretty, but what happened during the trials?
So everything about it, I would say, was sort of crying out that this was a quack remedy, a useless remedy, and so forth. And that's the way the medical profession dealt with it, even to the point of, let's say, not reporting any positive results with it, only emphasizing the negatives. But Sloan Kettering was objective initially, and they were interested in testing, as my big boss, Robert A. Good, once said, we'll look at it, we'll test anything, and if it has any promise at all. And they were good to their word for a couple of years. The test that they put it through, initially everybody was testing it in transplanted tumors. It didn't work. So then they decided, well, give it one more try. We'll try it in spontaneous tumors in animals, which were then becoming more like a human tumor, a tumor that arises without being injected with a carcinogen or injected with cancer cells, would be a more typical of what happens in a human being, a tumor that arises spontaneously in the animal. So they gave it to their best researcher, who was also retired. His name was Kanematsu Sugiura, and he tested it in special kind of mouse that spontaneously developed cancer in 80 to 90% of cases. It developed breast cancer, and then the breast cancer metastasized or spread to the lungs of these animals. And lo and behold, it worked. It stopped the spread of the cancer, which is the most important thing that a drug could do, because 90% of the people who die of cancer, even today, die of metastases, of the spread of the cancer to vital organs. So now, it didn't cure the cancers. It didn't particularly shrink the tumors. It stopped or slowed the growth of small tumors temporarily, but it had this enormous effect on the metastases. And based on his 60 years of research, he said that it kind of looks like a vitamin because the coats of the animals become shinier, they become frisky, even on the day that they're injected. By the afternoon of the morning that they're injected, you can see the difference in their behavior. And he, as I say, this man co-invented chemotherapy. He Wow. did the original Wow. research, is going back to 1909, on cancer in animals. There was no greater expert in the world on testing drugs in animals than Dr. Sugiura. So you had to listen. I mean, I wouldn't know the difference between a healthy mouse and a sick mouse, but he did. And he said this was, you know, pretty remarkable. But the most important thing, the thing we have to keep our eye on, this was the best agent ever discovered up until that point in stopping the spread of cancer, the most important question that confronts people treating advanced cancer.
So what happened?
Okay, I'll put it very briefly. In 1974, and again in 1975, the top leadership of Sloan Kettering, the presidents of the hospital, the institute, and the overall center, went to Washington and pleaded the case for Laetrile. They went to the National Institutes of Health, the National Cancer Institute, and then to the Food and Drug Administration, and the American Cancer Society was there, and other people were there, and they said, this stuff is working beautifully in animals, so we want to go ahead now and do a clinical trial. We've arranged to set up a clinical trial at a very good, very famous and important hospital in Mexico City called the November 22nd Hospital. They had identified people at that hospital who thought that Laetrile was of some interest, at least, to worthy of doing clinical trials. It wasn't a magic bullet, but it had some ameliorative benefits for patients. And they got shot down. We have the notes. Eric shows them in the film of the meetings, but I don't think that the notes, I think the notes are sanitized. I don't think they show what really happened, because the leaders came back after the March 1975 meeting, basically with their tails between their legs. I think somebody read them the Riot Act at that point. We know that the American Cancer Society was pressuring Robert Good, the president of Sloan Kettering, to let them handle all the publicity around Sloan Kettering's testing. And that's what happened. They did an abrupt about-face led by Lewis Thomas, who was the president of the center, and I think the person most culpable in all of this. I wanted to talk to Thomas after this happened. I couldn't understand why he had turned on a dime and gone from being at least neutral in public on the question to being completely lying about and denying, negating all of Segura's tests. So I asked my boss if I could talk to Thomas, and my boss said no, but I will talk to him, meaning himself. He would go. There was a little bit of rivalry between me and my boss because this was his most cherished contact in the center, the president of the whole center. So he went to talk, and we were on very close confidential terms, my boss and I. He would never lie to me or anything like that. And he came back. He was kind of red in the face, and he said, I asked Thomas and why he made these negative statements, and Thomas said, I'm not going to die on the barricades for Laetrile. It's only a palliative drug. If it were a cure, I might do so, but since it's only a palliative, meaning it only stopped the spread of the disease, it didn't destroy the tumors completely or remarkably shrink them, I won't die on the barricades. And I think that is the closest we have to insight into why they turned on a dime in March of 75 and then joined the crusade against Laetrile, when up until that point, for 3 years, they had been at least honest within the confines of the cancer establishment and kind of neutral within, you know, in the public sphere. So then it became a nightmare. Because we were then, as an institution, upholding a lie. Everything we said and did about Laetrile from that point on was wrong, was suspect, it was tainted by the fact that these people individually and collectively had decided to sacrifice the truth about Laetrile, the truth as they themselves saw it up until the day they went to Washington, to, for expediency's sake. So, you know, it's what makes the story, I think, both complicated and interesting, that it's not like a grade B thriller in the sense that there's the bad guys and there's the good guys and you know which kind of color hat each one wears. These guys could have been the biggest heroes of all. I mean, people would be making movies about them if they had just stuck to their guns. good caved first, but it wasn't so important. When Thomas caved, Lewis Thomas, when he caved in, everybody else ran for the exit.
So why was there so much pressure to cave? You're saying that the American Cancer Society was actively telling Sloan Kettering not to continue work with this. What was the motivation?
They had put their reputation on the line. They had put Laetrile as exhibit number one on their list of quack remedies. The public looked to them for truthful statements. Now, they could have said, I think that most people would have understood if they had said, look, stuff happens. You know, we thought it was negative because there really was no good evidence that it was a good treatment. But Sloan Kettering's now done this work. We're going to have to reconsider. That would have been the honest reaction. Instead, they panicked, and I think in some sense they thought they could bluster their way through. I mean, it was almost like they thought that their ideas were the objective reality. I'm not putting this terribly well, but it was like they were so egotistical that they thought they determined what was real and not real, not science determining, you know, not the outcome of a scientific experiment, but what their opinions were. And their opinions were, this is a bunch of dangerous quacks running around telling, and you know, they saw all kinds of dangers here, some of which were real and some of which were imaginary. They were afraid that people would go to Laetrile instead of doing conventional therapy. 70,000 people did. With all of their disapproval, at least 70,000 people did, ran to Mexico to get Laetrile. So you could see why their world was crumbling. And there was a whole other group of doctors, not well-credentialed, not really terribly brilliant or leadership quality from the, you know, I mean, these were the people who took the anti-Laetrile stance were the highest ranking people in all of medicine. This was the establishment. And up come these you know, kind of wacky people from mostly from California, and they've got a theory that about cancer. By the way, they developed this into a whole nother theory which involved the John Birch Society and the Rockefellers and conspiracies and this supposed anti-cancer vitamin.
Who did all that? You're saying the American Cancer Society?
No, the
Laetrileists. Okay, so the people who were taking it became cult-like in their belief that this was going to help them because they're grasping for life. So they over-marketed the stuff that they were clinging onto so they wouldn't die of cancer. That's kind of what happened?
The people who were marketing it, not the people taking it, but there became a lot of money involved in it. The U.S. government illegalized it, and it then became a black market item. And, of course, the price shot up. And then the government went hunting for the smugglers, and the John Birch Society got involved in this because the major parties wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole, and it became a circus. It was a complete circus. Yeah. And theories arose that this was not only a cure for cancer, but if you ate apricot kernels, you would be bulletproof from cancer. You would never get cancer, and people were eating handfuls of apricot, which contains cyanide. So if you ate enough of the stuff, you'd kill yourself. And that was another area of concern. But, you know, there was ample reason why the establishment was worried about Laetrile. Some people were abandoning good, effective conventional therapies to take this very still unproven thing. I mean, basically everything I was talking about happened in animals, which doesn't necessarily convert into human affairs. So, you know, they thought they had good reasons to oppose this. The problem was their opposition then slid over into denial of clear-cut facts. And they couldn't stand the thought that this thing that they had fought for 25 years actually turned out to have some merit to it. It wasn't the merit that the quacks were saying, but it had merit that Dr. Segura showed very clearly. It stopped the spread of cancer.
Laetrile had everything stacked up against it. I mean, think about it. You have an established quack remedy. You have the John Birch Society being its biggest supporter. You have the Laetrile proponents also not being honest and taking advantage of people. It was a mess. And then how, you know, Sloan Kettering, not to mention the fact that it's dirt cheap, nearly impossible to patent, impossible to regulate. You know, it just seems pretty obvious that they went, oh my God, after they realized it worked. You know, we gave it our best shot in D.C. They said no, so I guess we're going to have to get in line and, you know, lie about it.
Isn't it like a normal behavior? And Ralph, you would know this better, but if you have cancer and you've tried some traditional treatments, or you look at the research and you find out that chemotherapy doesn't have very good statistical odds for your kind of cancer, I know that if I had that, I would be reaching for pretty much the whole grab bag full of things that might potentially work. And if I could afford it, I would do all of them. Because, hey, like, I'm going to die, and I'd rather die broke and much later rather than, you know, die wealthy of painful tumors. So it's...
That's why cancer is a happy hunting ground for charlatans.
It's true, I suppose, yeah.
You know, you could we could brainstorm and come up with some, you know, plausible sounding remedy right here and now if we wanted to, and sell it over the internet, and we might make some money, or we might make a lot of money. I've never done that, but it's something one could do, and people do it. I mean, it sounds completely heartless, but that's the world that we live in. And yes, people do get desperate, and it is a big problem. The thing was, though, that the ACS, American Cancer Society, they, up until 1975, they had a very neat, they lived in a very neat world. Their world was divided up between good, honest, effective remedies and ineffective, fraudulent, quack remedies. And so that was a simple world for simple people, yeah. Simpler times.
Yeah.
In 1975, the biggest jolt, something that's actually still reverberating today in the whole cancer world, they were convinced to remove three treatments from their unproven methods list. One of them was Coley's toxins, which was a killed bacterial vaccine that was an early form of immune therapy. There was another form of vaccine or immune therapy removed from the list. And the third one was hypothermia or heat therapy. So, you know, it was never acknowledged that they had ever made a mistake, but implicit in this was the idea that, you know, they were not infallible. And up until that point, they were like more infallible than the Pope. Anything they said, I mean, there were millions of people who believed anything ACS said was the truth about cancer. So their world got shaken by that. And then, of course, along comes Laetrile. Now, if Laetrile works at any level, if it's biologically active in cancer patients and it's much less stops metastases, their whole world would have crumbled. I mean, their intellectual framework and... As we saw a few years later, you know, they really succumbed to their, in good measure, to their own institutional inertia, because they lost control of the breast cancer field to the Susan Komen Foundation and many other foundations that have come along. So ACS was very vulnerable because of their ultra conservatism. I mean, their I don't mean political conservatism, but their unwillingness to accept new ideas. So they were not in a position where they could take very many more blows at that time. And they basically put pressure, one individual in particular, put pressure on Bob Good, the president of Sloan Kettering Institute, at a moment when Good was extremely vulnerable to that kind of pressure. And the old institute was in a financial crisis. So if ACS had pulled its $4 million contribution out of Sloan Kettering at that point, it would have been a tremendous crisis. Good and the others would have lost their jobs, because Lawrence Rockefeller and Benno Schmidt didn't want to have to pay the shortfall for all the, you know, the money that was being lost by Sloan Kettering at that point. So they put pressure on. The other people, like the NIH, the Public Health Service, the National Cancer Institute, I mean, I think ego was the biggest driving factor there. They had gone, going back to 1953, they had been issuing these statements saying, we know what the deal is with Laetrile, it doesn't work, don't go anywhere near it. FDA, the same thing. FDA wouldn't approve the clinical trial. And they only, a very good book, history written about FDA, that came out about 2 years ago, explicitly says that FDA was waiting to line up the anti-Laetrileists at a number of institutions in order to have them do the trial. You see, they didn't trust the leadership of Sloan Kettering. They were too progressive. So they didn't want to let good, and especially Lloyd Old, the vice president of Sloan Kettering, have anything to do with the testing of Landrieu, because then it might have come out positive. They were terrified, I think, of Old, because Old was this young, dynamic, brilliant guy, talented, I mean, genius-level guy, who was, if not pro-Landrieu, he was at least very open to any new idea, especially Coley's toxins. He was instrumental in getting that immunotherapy removed from the ACS quack list, but very open to Landrieu. He had all the major Landrieuists come to the 13th floor of Sloan Kettering and give presentations, and treated them with respect. And this was unheard of, absolutely unheard of. So it was a little bit, you know, ahead of its time, I would say. And they couldn't prevail. Old ran away. Thomas just caved completely. Good just did whatever they told him to do. And the only ones who stood firm were, only one really, was Dr. Segura. And then, of course, I came along as a public relations person and a science writer. I was not involved in the testing, but I just couldn't abide what they were doing. I mean, essentially, they threw Dr. Segura under the bus. I mean, as we would say today, they just sacrificed his reputation and good name and slandered him in their own publication, said that he was biased, that he had positive results because of his bias, which is fighting words in science.
I've continuously seen misinformation and very nasty targeted campaigns to discredit people who disrupt the status quo. Some of the physicians I respect the most get the most grief. Some of them had to move from one state to another to continue practicing stuff that I've personally seen just transform people's health. But it's not the common thing. But so it feels to me like cancer therapy, you know, has definitely changed something over the past 40 or so years since all this really went down. Have there been major changes in cancer therapy since then, or are we kind of, you know, treading water?
Oh, I think there's been major changes. On the plus side, they now know how to give chemotherapy. First of all, they know how to give it in a more humane way. Yeah. So it doesn't have the incredible side effects that I witnessed at Sloan Kettering in the 1970s. Not as often. So they've gotten a good handle, partially because they've incorporated complementary medicine into, you know, to a certain degree, into convention as part of a conventional approach. So that's very positive. Chemotherapy is actually quite effective in certain areas. Like, I'd say the most important of all is preventing recurrences of breast cancer. The numbers are quite striking if you have a very risky, very high risk kind of breast cancer. The addition of chemotherapy, which has now sort of been settled, which ones to give, there's the three drug regimen that's pretty effective. And this could result in maybe as much as a 20% increase in 10-year survival of the people who take it. And that's nothing to sneeze at. I mean, you know, this is very important. It's very, very important. Colon cancer as well. We now know that most colon cancers develop from polyps. So if people have colonoscopy routinely, every 5 years or so, every 3 years after, if they found a polyp, then you can prevent most colon cancer. Most people don't realize this. Despite Katie Couric's campaign to get the world to understand this, I bet, you know, most people I talk to have never had a colonoscopy. So there are areas of progress without a doubt. I mean, it's a different world. Plus, intellectually speaking, an oncologist from 1974 would hardly recognize the oncology of 2014, because it's all about genes and it's all about targeted drugs and about markers and about growth pathways. And, you know, there's all kinds of fascinating stuff going on at the scientific level, but we haven't cracked the basic problem that Landrieu addressed, stopping the metastases, or at least being able to treat, stopping the spread of the cancer. There's some very promising leads. Even basic anti-inflammatory drugs may be able to do this, but we don't have any more proof of them either. And I would suggest that has a lot to do with the economics of the situation, that there's very little money to be made from, you know, sort of traditional non-steroidal anti-inflammatories like aspirin. So there is less than overwhelming enthusiasm for doing the trials that would prove whether or not aspirin and the other NSAIDs are as effective as they look to be in terms of preventing the spread of cancer.
What are the three most exciting new, not yet proven, but maybe with potential breakthroughs in cancer that you've come across?
Well, you know, I mean, I have my bias, which is towards the less toxic complementary treatments. I just mentioned one of them, which is that, you know, there is some amazing data that's come out of Belgium where they looked at the people who, women who got anti-inflammatory drugs as part of their anesthesia for their breast cancer surgery, and then compared those who received standard opioid-based analgesics, and there was like four or five times as many recurrences of the cancer at 1 to 2 years, a common time breast cancers often recur, than in the women who received the anti-inflammatories. So this is tremendously promising and important. And when you look at what's the list of the traditional, this was a traditional anti-inflammatory, aspirin over the counter. Yeah. So this is tremendous. The other two things that I think are the most important, both within the world of conventional therapy and also the world of alternative therapy, if we still use that term, is immunotherapy. Manipulating or enhancing the immune system so that it attacks the cancer. That was the idea behind the Coley's toxins, and it's still very widely practiced in Europe especially, but it's the darling child now of conventional oncology, the so-called anti-PD-1 and anti-PD-L1 drugs. This is the hottest item there is. They've just given accelerated approval by the FDA, and you're going to see a lot more and hear a lot more about that. So anti-inflammatory, immune therapy, and the third one is hypothermia, heat therapy, the best adjuvant treatment in the world, the one that can be added to almost any other treatment to make it more effective. And there's a tremendous research that's been done on this, I mean breakthrough research, showing that when you add heat therapy to conventional chemotherapy or radiation therapy, you like double the effectiveness of those other treatments.
And double the survival.
Certainly improve the survival, and you double the response rates. And it's blow away research, and this goes back now many years. I mean, the earlier results, some of them were even better, but we have rigorous, you know, phase three clinical trials out of Holland and Germany now. I mean, stuff that took years and years and years, maybe decades, to put together and get these trials done, and they were highly positive. And everybody in oncology knows they were positive. But what they say at the meetings is, oh, the problem with that, with hypothermia, is you can't get it. That's the problem with it. You can't get it.
Not in the U.S.
Sure. Not in the U.S. There's only three hospitals using the same machinery that they used in Europe to get those results. Three hospitals. And they won't use them because FDA's only approved one indication, cervical cancer, stages 2 and 3. I mean, it's literally going to take thousands of years at the current pace before hypothermia will be fully approved in the U.S.
So, you know, it's also interesting. So I'll say one quick thing. Right, is that going back to the U.S. and going back to, like, you know, why would they do this? Hyperthermia was tested pretty rigorously at Duke University in North Carolina. They were given permission for, I believe, phase 3 randomized by the FDA. And the moment that occurred, the NIH came in and ripped all of their funding away from them. So you can make what you want of that as well. While 125 clinics in Germany are giving this, and it's all over Holland.
So with hyperthermia, you actually take the blood out, heat the blood up, and put it back in. If memory serves, there's some technique like that. But so how does hyperthermia work, the real short version, because we're running up towards the end of the show, but I'm sure some people listening are interested.
They just run a current through the tumor by putting an electrode on one side and another one on the other side. That's the main way.
Oh, interesting.
Dinner plate sized electrodes. I mean, they just sit on the top of the patient, and then the current goes through. The current may also be part of the treatment. That's a big discussion.
I suspect it is. Okay.
Yes. You can put somebody in a tent and heat up the tent, either heat up water or actually use infrared or microwave or whatever. You can heat the person, whole person. That's whole body hypothermia.
Yeah.
As Eric said, there's 125 clinics at least in Germany using that right now. That's whole body. The FDA bans whole body, and the one clinical situation to give whole body hypothermia was shut down 2 years ago for lack of funding.
I know we're getting towards the top of the hour, and I just want to make sure I get a few things in.
Yeah, Eric,
first of all, this film, considering how challenging the subject matter is and how polarizing it can be, is doing remarkably well beyond our expectations. We got a great review in the New York Times. The Daily News said, though it's a documentary, it's just as thrilling as The Insider, you know, with Russell Crowe about big tobacco.
Well,
we're in 5 cities theatrically. By the time your listeners hear this, it'll be right before our big opening at the AMC Pacific Place 11 in Seattle. And basically, the AMC is giving us a shot at possibly going nationwide with this. It all comes down to that opening weekend at the AMC Pacific Place 11 in Seattle. Any Seattle listeners, we sort of beg of you to come out. And in fact, if you come out and approach me and say, I heard you on Bulletproof Radio, I will give you a free DVD signed just for coming out to this theater opening weekend, September 19th, September 20th, or September 21.
You should mention that I'll be giving a lecture with question and answer.
Correct. And you also, if you show up to the AMC, take your ticket stub. Again, Seattle Pacific Place 11, Monday night, the 22nd of September, we're going to host a free Q&A with Ralph, discussing all his expertise to anyone who wants to listen, have a nice Q&A afterwards, and it'll be free for those who have purchased a ticket for the AMC that weekend.
So, Eric, one thing I'll ask you to do is make sure that you send me an email with all that info right after us recording the show. I'm going to do my best to get the show edited with all the audio quality and all that so we can get it up ahead of time. But if we don't hit that window, what I will do is I'll put this out on social media and we'll do what we can to make sure that the Seattle area gets to see this. And fortunately, I have a lot of the Bulletproof teams in Seattle. I'm, you know, 45 minutes away in Victoria, at least if you like float planes. So I'm not sure I can come down that weekend, but I'll do my best. And we'll make sure that we get the word out, because this is the sort of thing where it is an exciting story. It is a really good movie. And I'm really hoping that for listeners who sat here and listened, you guys have made something special. And Ralph is an incredibly credible, believable guy, amazing credentials, who's spent his life looking at the sum total of cancer treatments, not rejecting chemo, or, you know, looking at it as a blind thing where it's just going to work no matter what. So if you really want to kind of understand how scientific research in general gets biased by organizational hubris, inability to admit that they're wrong, and things like that. We see this happening in our society over and over. It's happened in this scenario, at least we think, and there's room for more research on Laetril. But it's happened with the low-fat diet. I mean, this came about from, you know, a 28-year-old guy who'd never treated an obese person throughout a theory, and the government didn't want to admit it was wrong. So here we are. Millions of people suffering and obese later, kind of scratching their heads going, what just happened to us? And what just happened was a breakdown of core basic science for whatever political reasons. And I don't think it's really a John Birch situation either. It's just organizational hubris. And it's not even one evil person. It's many people making many small decisions to just bias things in the direction that's convenient or less fearful.
Right. Yeah. Great. There's a great parallel there.
Now, you guys have a petition that I also think listeners would be interested in hearing about with change.org.
Sure. If you go to secondopinionfilm.com, you can't miss the banner to find that. And you can also read all of the reviews. You can look at all the documents we discussed and evaluate them for yourself, trailer, all the dates for the tour, the film. Everything's there. secondopinionfilm.com.
Awesome. And in fact, it's great because I was about to ask you guys for that. And this will be in the show notes as well. But it's a film that's worth watching. And it's not just about cancer. It's a story about how politics change health research And this matters for all of us because it's happening right now with other sets of science altogether.
You want to know what else is very exciting that we should put in? Unbelievably exciting and unexpected, on August the 19th, two huge universities, research centers in Germany decided they're going to tackle amygdalin or laetrile. They published it in PLOS One, just came out August the 19th, unrelated to our release. We're very blown away by it. And there it is. It blocks cancer growth in vitro. And they want to continue. Ralph's been in touch with them. Okay. And they actually want to do a genuinely well-designed clinical trial in people over there. So that's unbelievable, you know, to go along with the release of this. So
our ultimate goal would be to help them financially to do that trial. If we are successful enough.
Yeah. If this film goes nationwide, we have a nonprofit sympathetic to us. We can theoretically raise a whole lot of money through the film as a springboard for the Germans to do this.
Definitely consider a crowdfunding campaign too. I mean, there's so many people who've had cancer touch their lives. I've lost relatives to cancer, and I know from my work in anti-aging that we're not doing everything we could do, and that some of the things that are most promising may not hit the market, if they ever do, for 30 or 40 years at the current rate. So I think you'll find that there's a lot of community passion for unbiased but open-minded science that is driven by making people well rather than corporate interests combined with making people well. There's a question that I've asked everyone who's been on the show. And I want to ask both of you the question kind of separately, because you're at different stages in your careers and you do very different things. And the question is, what three pieces of advice would you have from your journey? And not just dealing with laetrile, but just in life, the three pieces of advice for people who want to perform better. So people who want to kick more ass at life, not at work or whatever else. What are the three most important things you've learned that you'd offer them? Eric, why don't you go first?
Sure. I actually had to write it down, so I'm going to read if you don't mind. My number one is just to stay absolutely true to yourself and follow your gut and what your instinct and gut tells you, and even if everyone around you thinks you're absolutely crazy. And number two, I find that failing at something is the only way to learn anything. Many people fail at something and they, you know, have a difficult time dusting themselves off. I find that my failures are something I should embrace, and it, of course, makes my successes even more valuable. There's only one way to learn. I can't, you know, a parent always wants you not to fail at things, but in reality, they should just let you fail so you can learn the hard way. My last thing I would say is just take chances. And for me personally, I've had to ignore everything my sort of indoctrinated educational sort of system has given me and taught me. I had to sort of throw it all away and start over. Because in my opinion, every single human being that's made a difference in our world, whether it be Steve Jobs or Elon Musk or whomever, including yourself, have done so by going against what has been told and taught. You know, look at people like Albert Einstein and all of them. You can name them forever. But they pushed against what they're told and what has been established. And they stepped outside of bounds and they succeeded. And I find that, in my opinion, if they hadn't have done that, they wouldn't have been successful. If they had stuck to the so-called rules, they wouldn't have made it. So I hope that answers that. Those three.
Oh, that's a wonderful set of answers. Thank you, Eric. Ralph, what do you think?
Well, my philosophical answer is to question authority. I think in particular, that means question the institutions that set themselves up as the experts on health advice and health matters, not just the American Cancer Society, but I think all the other major institutions, a fundraise. Don't be overly impressed by the so-called nonprofit status that, you know, that certain institutions have, because they can be just as prejudiced, if not more so, than for-profit institutions. In particular, though, I'm very fired up about the whole diabetes epidemic. 75% of the people who are 70 who make it to the age of 70 in the United States are either diabetic or pre-diabetic. That's a figure I recently read. So I would say that if you are suffering from ill health, you should always suspect diabetes. And if you're gaining weight over what you were, let's say, when you were in high school or college, I mean, that would be the first thing that I would look to. And I would really try very hard to nail down whether or not this problem is creeping up on you. We're actually extremely fortunate in that there is a little device called the glucometer or glucose meter that you can buy for like $12, and you can test your own blood on a pretty regular basis to see how much glucose or sugar there is in your system. That sugar is not an innocuous thing. It can glycate or cope with sugar. Not only your red blood cells, but your white blood cells, diminish your immunity. It can get into your kidneys, get into your eyes. I mean, this is extremely toxic. I remember when I was a kid, you know, they used to talk about people pouring corn syrup into people's gas tanks, their cars, you know, to punish them or to get even. Well, I mean, in a way, we're doing that in our own society. All of the sugar, the high fructose corn syrup, the rampant carbs that we consume that are unnatural to our bodies. This is like corn syrup in our gas tank. It gums up our, you know, put it in simple terms, our whole works. So I would say, be very proactive with your health. Very proactive. Use a glucometer if you have any reason to believe that this might be creeping up on you. Get A1C test done by your physician to see what your glucose has been over the past 4 months or so. Take your blood pressure routinely. Get an app that tests your pulse. See how that's going. Be proactive because, you know, once the dam breaks, it's very hard to fix it. Do this ahead of time. And you can reverse these things, absolutely can reverse them. And by the way, there's a lot of good research going on now to examine the connection between high blood glucose and cancer. Cancer cells are avid consumers of glucose. They love that high glucose environment. And by reducing the amount of glucose, you may be able to also reduce the virulence of the cancer.
I've had Dominic D'Agostino on talking about ketosis and cancer on the show, and it's amazing what happens when you stop burning sugar as fuel for a while. The cancer really doesn't like that very much.
Very much not. And the biggest myth, one of the biggest myths going, is that if you don't get 60 or 120 grams of carbohydrates, you'll die, you'll fall down, your brain. But you can become keto adapted. Actually, your body is running on ketones. You have tremendous energy, and you feel better and you look better. And how bad could it be? Your numbers get better. Your triglycerides get better. Your cholesterol. So there is some unbelievable myth at the core of the generalized health advice that the American public is getting and has been getting since the day you referenced Ansel Keys. You know, the guy, quote unquote, invented the low fat diet, got onto the cover of Time magazine. But we're, you know, it's a myth bound culture. We're running after following advice that has no factual basis to it. But it's incredibly profitable for the big corporations to sell you these, you know, concocted foods that are really, really bad for you. So my advice is twofold. You need to pursue this. But you also need to use your intelligence. That's the most important tool of all, and your critical intelligence. If you try to change your diet and it goes against the standard advice of the culture, the minute anything happens adverse or you have run into any kind of waves or bumps or whatever, you're going to be at a tremendous loss if you don't know how to investigate these questions yourself. So I come back to question authority, because you have to think, are these so-called authorities really as smart as they say they are and really as objective as they claim to be? And I would say, not always.
Well, that is amazing advice. Would you guys, one more time, name the URL, talk about the dates and where people can learn more about this, the dates in Seattle, just so they hear it one more time?
Sure. It's secondsopinionfilm.com. And you know, even if you're not in Seattle, it's available on demand as well. The links are all very clear on the website. We have a Vimeo on demand and, of course, Blu-rays and DVDs. But Yes, and the Seattle opening is the most important weekend, is what it all boils down to, is Friday, September the 19th, Saturday, September the 20th, and Sunday, the 21st of September. And we are going to try to be there as many times as the theater will allow us to be Q&As. And we're going to get a place really close by and be there and do Q&As as much as possible. We found that every time we did Q&As, like say in New York, the place was basically sold out. And in fact, it did so well in New York, they extended it a week. So uh-huh. We want to take advantage of the fact that people want to hear us talk after seeing the film and try to be there. And again, if you go to the AMC that weekend, save your ticket stub. We're going to have a free lecture with Ralph Monday night. We'll announce where that will be. And if you show up to the AMC and you see me there, and you say that you saw or heard about this on Bulletproof, I will happily give you a signed copy of the DVD of this film. By the way, the DVD also has an extra whole movie attached to it that is not playing in the theaters. There's so much to the story. I added another 74 minutes of footage and clips and interviews that pertain to where Laetrile went since the story and where Wealth has gone since, where the cancer industry really has gone since these days. So,
do you guys mind if I can convince a few of Team Bulletproof people to show up with a few extra t-shirts? You up for that?
Oh, I'm totally up for that.
All right.
Are you kidding me? Oh, yes.
Let me see if I can twist their arm to go to a free movie. All right. We'll make that happen. And finally, I'm going to hit you guys up. I've been spending the last 6 months making a documentary. It's not done yet, on toxic mold in our environment and in our homes and its link actually to cancer, as well as a host of other inflammatory and neurodegenerative diseases. Interviewing experts around the country, as well as people who've been exposed and are affected by what they eat and what they breathe. So I have no idea. I've never made a documentary before, but I've invested a huge amount of just passion and time and, frankly, and money in doing it. So you guys got into theaters. Holy crap, that's amazing. So I'm going to call you later and pick your brain so I can ask how to do the same thing with the movie that's going to help people.
I'd love to share my experience. It was a huge hustle, huge learning experience. And I feel like I have created a well-oiled machine for my next movie. Yeah, it's a long conversation. I'll be happy to talk to you.
Oh, lovely. Thank you so much. And thanks for being on Bulletproof Radio today. Have an awesome day.
Thanks. You too.
Thank you.
If you're looking for a way to know which foods are making you weak, check out the free app called Bulletproof Food Sense. This is an awesome app. Bulletproof Food Sense is free, and it makes a huge difference in how you manage and control your stress.
The Human Upgrade, formerly Bulletproof Radio, was created and is hosted by Dave Asprey. The information contained in this podcast is provided for informational purposes only and is not intended for the purposes of diagnosing, treating, curing, or preventing any disease. Before using any products referenced on the podcast, consult with your healthcare provider, carefully read all labels, and heed all directions and cautions that accompany the products. Information found or received through the podcast should not be used in place of a consultation or advice from a healthcare provider. If you suspect you have a medical problem or should you have any healthcare questions, please promptly call or see your healthcare provider. This podcast, including Dave Asprey and the producers, disclaim responsibility for any possible adverse effects from the use of information contained herein. Opinions of guests are their own, and this podcast does not endorse or accept responsibility for statements made by guests. This podcast does not make any representations or warranties about guest qualifications or credibility. This podcast may contain paid endorsements and advertisements for products or services. Individuals on this podcast may have a direct or indirect financial interest in products or services referred to herein. This podcast is owned by Bulletproof Media.